All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gym Fear 138 podcast. Thank you all very much for tuning in. And I bring another special guest, the one, the only, the rider of the soul cycle, the reigning dragon of horror, Brian Niemeyer himself. Brian, thanks for coming on the program, man.
Thanks for having me. Again, thanks to everybody for listening.
So did you have a, because you got in contact with me about coming on, if I remember this right, and I'm kind of a scatterbrained alcoholic, so I might not.
But notice.
did you have anything particular that you wanted to go over, or did you just want to like just talk?
Let me tell you, the reason that I got in touch with you was I belatedly listened to your excellent episode with Daddy Warpig, my co-host, on Geek Gab, which everybody should also check out on YouTube, SoundCloud, and now iTunes. And yeah, both of you kept dropping my name. I was just I was just turning beet red. You know, I was just so humbled by it. But it seemed like you had some stuff you wanted to discuss, so I'm really here to take your questions and I'll just talk about whatever.
Okay then. Well, if I get to pick your brain for a minute,
yeah.
I do have a couple of questions, I'm not gonna lie. Specifically about Netherial. Cause when I read that book, it blew my mind. It was right up there with like Planet of Adventure and all of this old pulpy stuff that I've been reading, and like I don't know. It was akin to discovering The Witcher for the first time, not knowing that he was an Elric clone, who is a bad clone of Conan.
copy of a copy.
Yeah, but this is something that's actually original, so I do have some questions. So how did you come up with the idea? I know that writers get that all the time, and you know, my answer for my stuff is pretty generic. It just kind of comes to me. But this universe seems very well worked out. Like, I didn't notice not a single plot hole that I can think of. So did it start as this cohesive thing, or did you just have an idea for a character and then it built from there, or?
Well, do you want the long or the short version? What do we have time for?
Let's see. It's 9:20. I have a full bottle of whiskey and a full pack of cigarettes. I'm good to go all night, man. Whichever version you feel like.
It's dark out and we're wearing sunglasses.
Damn straight.
Okay, because authors always have the panel answer, which is pithy and quick and soundbite friendly. And then there's the hanging out in the bar, the hotel, you know, after hours, and, you know, you're talking with other writers. Then there's that version. So I'll just go ahead and tell you the full story as well as I can remember it, because I've been working on this universe for about 17 years now. I know it predates 9/11. Yeah, so that's probably one of the reasons why I feel so fleshed out, because it is. I spent a lot of time polishing and sanding.
I mean, I think I made a joke about it before, but I'm actually deadly serious. Like, if you wanted to, you could turn Netherial into a full RPG setting, and it would make sense.
Yeah, I know, because I did. So you are correct.
Oh, really? So when can I get the nice hardback copy on Lulu?
I don't know. Another 17 years? Probably not that long. Because I found something out. I'm not a game designer. I'm very much a fiction writer. I've been working on the SoulCycle RPG since before Netherial came out. It was after I'd finished a pretty good draft of the book that's pretty much what you've got now, just a little less polished before JIG got to it. But I started just working on an RPG because I'm like, you know, I finished a draft. I don't want to get back to revision right away. So, you know, I got these ideas kicking around, and I've always found that gaming out my stories helps to give me that perspective. That is why there are so few plot holes, is because I actually game this out. And I have players show me, oh, okay, there's something my characters didn't think of. I'll make sure to fill that hole, or I'll explore that avenue. So I've been using D&D, and again, this is how long, because we went from AD&D second ed with the skills and powers player's option to third ed. in the process of like gaming out my novel outlines.
Wow.
Yeah. So, cause I hung on to AD&D for a while after third came out. Cause I dig it. It's actually my favorite. Anyhow. Yeah,
third ed was pretty good. That was the one that I started with. Well, third I started with 3.5 actually, but splitting hairs.
Yeah, that's fine. But anyway, so yeah, I would game this stuff out and I figured, okay, well, you know what? Nothing perfectly expresses really the game mechanic that I'm running off of. You know, my magic system, as Brandon Sanderson would say. So I thought, okay, let's make this. So I've made a percentage-based system, okay, where everything is a skill. Because you don't have to be a particular class to learn how to use workings. Now, to use Nexism, that's an inherited ability that not everyone has. And some races have more of a penchant for it than others. But workings are just skills. They're basically high-level math. Anybody can learn to use. Just one organization has made it illegal for anyone else to learn or teach it who is not a member or who has a license from them. So you can have a license from the guild or be a member of the guild to learn and use workings legally. And the penalties for using them illegally are pretty harsh. So they're just skills. I wanted players to be able to have access to them if they really wanted to. You know, it's kind of like getting a piece of like military-grade tech in Cyberpunk or something. You know, if you're not a steersman, but you want to learn a working.
Yeah.
Or it's like in Star Wars, learning a Force skill in the era after Revenge of the Sith, okay? You know, during the Empire.
Yeah, okay.
It's like that. So it exists, but yeah, I've had a couple of test campaigns. My normal group likes it, but then I brought it to some really hardcore guys, like a group that has members of the group that at Gen Con for like 4 years in a row took first place in Wizards of the Coast official D&D tournament. Okay, so these guys are serious.
Wow.
Yeah, they have nice plaques and everything. And they said, it's a bit too BRP. It's a bit too basic role-playing. You know, they liked the story that I had going on with it, but they didn't like the mechanics as much. So I decided, okay, before this thing is ready for prime time, you know, I just need to have some serious game designers take a look at it and, you know, see what can be streamlined, what fat can be trimmed. I might need to scrap the whole system and start over. Hmm. So it's going to be a while, if ever. Although they did say, yeah, you've put way too much work into this not to eventually sell it. So
I would we'll probably tell you the same thing.
Okay, well, so there we go. It's unanimous. So there's an answer to that question, but I believe you were originally asking, you know, how I got the idea for an ethereal.
Yeah, that's because it's such a fascinating universe. Like everything seemed very original, especially like the blend of horror and science fiction and fantasy with, you know, these people are out in a space empire and they go to different planets and they have big starships. But at the same time, they have magic and, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that happens that is just kind of unexplainable unless you really know. Like you said, it's high level math, but unless you know the mechanics behind it, then it might as well be magic. And just like I said, some of the book parts of that book are legitimately terrifying.
Thanks.
So I'm just like, I just can't imagine how you came up with something so original.
Well, let's digress a minute because I'm interested here. I mean, I'm the Dragon of Horror, like you said, so this is in my wheelhouse. What scared you the most? I'd like a list of your three greatest fears, actually. And then I'm going to go order a hockey mask and get your address. Anyway, what scared you the most?
Oh, God, there were so many parts of that book. Like, honestly, the parts that scared me the most, because I'm like a horror junkie. Like, I watch horror movies. I read horror stories. I read horror stories on YouTube for the longest time. You know, I love horror, so when I'm reading a horror story, it has to do something. It has to really get inside my head to freak me out. And there weren't any particular parts of that book that necessarily got inside my head. And maybe that's due to the blend. But apart from the parts where certain characters were in danger, because over the course of this book, you really do come to care for these people. Like, they're well-fleshed out, developed characters. They feel like real people, you know, like how characters should be, which was one of the most impressive things I thought about the book. So when you had parts like, I don't want to drop too many spoilers here for the people who haven't read it yet, which if you haven't read it yet, the fuck are you doing with your life? But anyway.
Go turn us off. Go read it. What are you doing here?
Yeah, pause the podcast. Go read the book and then come back. But like the part where Teg, I think is his name. It's been a couple of months where Teg, and Suleiman switched bodies. That or when he was climbing that tower to light the blaze. That part was legitimately terrifying because you're like I never had that moment. Where, because I don't read ahead. I just read the book. I don't flip ahead in books. So I, and the way that this book had been set up so far, I had no idea if Teg was going to live. Like, that scared the hell out of me, because he's one of my favorite characters. I absolutely love that character. And he's climbing up this tower and going through all of this stuff and almost drowning, and he gets to the top and gets attacked and everything, and I'm just like, is Brian gonna kill Teg? That's the part that actually, like, really, really freaked me out, was not knowing whether or not these characters were safe, you know?
Well, Lovecraft always said that the fear of the unknown is the greatest fear. And as individuals, we've all got to decide how do we confront that fear, because none of us knows everything, right?
Right.
We, that's a fear we've all got to face. So, yeah, thanks. That's very important feedback, and Teg loves you too, for sure. I'm glad to dig him. I had a lot of fun writing Teg. So, okay, thanks for the answer. Now, to finally get back to the genesis of Netherial. So one day, I was sitting at our card table at home, like a Saturday night or something kind of like this, and one thing I've always done since I was a kid was just, I'll put little models together. Like, not even out of model kits. Sometimes I'll do that, but just out of scrap. Like, the old frames of, like, Warhammer 40K figurines after I punched out the figs and glued them together, just the plastic frames that are left. I'll just, like, cut those up and make, like, the little skeletons of, like, creatures and spaceships and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. And then sometimes, like when I was a kid, I'd go out back and like stuff some black cats in there and shoot them with a bottle rocket fired out of the back end of a wiffle ball bat. You know, good, clean, wholesome fun. So I've always enjoyed taking things apart more than building them. I suppose that says something about me psychologically. So I just got the idea. I'm like, I want to make this black, just menacing looking ship. It's like just all sharp angles and just honestly ugly, but kind of impressive looking, just kind of intimidating. You know, so my original idea was kind of like a stealth bomber, only way bigger and with some more, you know, with a wider beam, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started working on that, and it started kind of taking on a life of its own, and the project started getting away from it. I actually remember I had the TV on in the background, and the remake of Beverly Hillbillies with Jim Varney as Jed Clampett was on in the background. Remember that place? So, and I think it was like right after he died or something, so perhaps the speed of Jim Varney inspired me. I don't know. But the man is a national treasure. But I just got this idea, and I hadn't read it yet, but I just heard about it. I come across the story Those Who Walk Away from Umalas by Le Guin, I believe, wrote that.
Hmm.
Familiar with that story at all?
I'm not, but if it's Le Guin, then I'm familiar with her work.
Pretty sure it is. I think she wrote a Hugo for it. The audience will have to double check us here. But the premise of the story is just there's this utopian city, right, where no one wants for anything, everyone's needs are taken care of, and there's peace and prosperity. But the price of it is that somewhere in the city, there's a basement room, like dirt floor, filthy, no windows, no light. And in this room, there may or may not be like a semi-retarded child. Could be boy or girl, doesn't really matter. But the kid doesn't know what he's done, doesn't know why he's there, but this kid's just locked up in this room, you know, is fed slop like once a day, so he's half starved. Every time the door is open, like to muck out the room or feed him, he just, you know, pleads with his captors, you know, I promise, you know, I don't know what I did, but I won't do it again, I'm sorry. And they just don't talk to him, they just shut the door again. So this kid just lives in absolute darkness and fear and suffering until he dies. And then they get another kid, is, you know, what's implied.
Hmm. Wow.
So
that's pretty fucking dark.
Yeah, it's intense. So again, they say that where originality really comes from is a synthesis of two ideas that no one's ever considered before. So I thought of, well, what about instead of a city, there is a ship that is powered by the suffering of a child. And I think you can see where I'm going with this.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So that was where the initial story came from, and then where the initial concept came from. Then just started asking myself questions, because that's what you do. You, every writer I know, like, has had at least one Eureka moment like this, where you just think of it. I'm like, man, bear pig, or some weird chimera or something. And, well, where did this come from? You just start asking why, what if, how, you know, the five reporters' questions, until I figured out where this thing came from.
Okay. And that's kind of where all of the characters and how all of the rest of the universe developed and everything like that.
It expanded slowly from there over years.
Okay. That's very interesting, because like a lot of writers that I hear talk about their story ideas, like you said earlier, they just kind of give this boilerplate, you know, the con answer, I guess, this just, like you said, a pithy, you know, popcorn response. But whenever you get them alone and you actually get them talking about it, that's not exactly something that I've heard another author come up with yet. So once again, you know, points for points for originality, even in your creative process.
Yeah, thanks. Go ahead.
This isn't exactly a deep question. This is just to satisfy my personal curiosity. Is it Gen or Gen?
Both.
Both?
I believe it's in...
Now you're just messing with me, man.
I'm not. I believe it's in... It should be in the glossary that Midgarders pronounce it Gen, and Kethans prefer Gen. So whenever Jern or Nocturne, really anyone else, is saying it, it's Gen. Like, Jern refers to himself as Gen. Teg, and in... Have you read Soul Dancer yet?
No, I have started it, but I haven't gotten very far.
Okay. Well, this is in terms of a spoiler, but... Kevin's, like, Teg and Aslan say Jen.
Okay, so it all depends on who's talking, you know, pronunciation via region. That's a pretty cool concept. Usually there's, like, a way to pronounce it, you know? But this really kind of goes back to, you know, kind of calls back to the whole GIF and JIF debate.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. Technically, the more preferred, the more widespread pronunciation is Gen.
Okay.
But... it's kind of like, well, do you spell center E-R-R-E? Well, you won't get it marked wrong in a spelling test either way. So if you call again a Gen, he's not going to give you shit over it.
You'll just have to get used to your localized word processing software, putting red lines under everything.
Yep. I hate those. They're so stupid until you train them.
Yeah, you really do have to put in a lot of effort to get those things to recognize all of the words that you made the fuck up.
Yeah, so yeah, to set the record straight here, because I've got an audio version coming out, and hopefully you'll get to do it. I'm pulling for you.
Good news on that front. Since I found out that this vision loss is going to be permanent, I have told my partner over at Dimension Bucket Media to just go ahead and send everything off to Castalia House, and if they send us something back, you know, like, okay, let's see how you do with this, then we'll just get started on it right away. So
good. I'm glad you pulled the trigger.
Yep. Just decided to go ahead and see what happens. You know, hopefully, because I would love to record an ethereal, and that little piece of information about the pronunciation is going to be very useful.
Right. So speaking of which, one more tip that I noticed from your audition, which was great, by the way, which is the main female co-protagonist's name is pronounced Nocturne.
Nakvin.
Nakvin, yeah.
Nakvin. How was I pronouncing it? Nakvin?
I think you said Nak. Yeah, like that. So it's, okay. It's Nak isn't like knock on wood, and then VIN is like vehicle identification number. So Nakvin.
Okay, I will bear that in mind if I get the job. There's all kinds of questions that I wanted to ask you about you know, how to voice different characters, but I won't get into that right now because that's going to be really boring for everybody else.
But I'm interested, but yeah.
But
your charger.
One thing that I did notice about this, like I said, it's one of the most original pieces of fiction that I've ever read. But I did see some serial numbers in there. And I don't know if it's just because I do this so much that I'm able to like pick up on it in other writers. I just have this question. How much anime do you watch?
I really don't watch it anymore. I kind of stopped like around 2000.
Really?
Well, and here I found out why. I never figured out why, because I used to be huge in anime, man. Like starting in high school and then even into college, I just couldn't get enough, and I went to the cons and everything. But then at a certain point, like right around 2000, 2001, I just lost interest. I just fell out of the hobby. And I'm kicking myself because this person will probably listen, but I think it was a guest on Geek Gab, like while we were either in the chat or while we were talking before or after the show, who pointed out that there was one guy, okay, who used to mix the paints for every anime studio. Just this one dude, and he had a technique for doing it. And it is why every anime that was still drawn on a cell looked the way it did. It's because for like 30 years, this one dude was doing the paint for him. And then And then in 1998, he suffered a massive heart attack and had to retire.
Damn.
Yeah, and they couldn't find anyone.
That's why everything looks more generic nowadays.
Because they had to switch to like all computer animation.
Yeah. Yeah, I really have noticed that. Like, I just got done watching, like, Kokoro Connect and, like, interviews with Monster Girls and stuff like that. And they're good shows, but the animation, and even with things like, you know, One Punch Man, it's good animation, but the art style is very generic. It just, like, everybody who's not a main character, and even some of the main characters, really seem to have kind of same face going on.
And it's become very safe, because back in the 80s and early 90s, you had the bubble economy driving this, where anybody could find an angel investor to give him the money to produce an OAV from even the most obscure manga, right? Or even an original idea. So it was like when the mob would fund movies in the 70s here, right? Yeah. Look into that. If you want a story, Jay Leno has some interesting and harrowing stories about dealing with the mob and showbiz in the 70s and 80s.
That should be very interesting.
It's really interesting. Like, well, one quick aside, there was, and you can find this on YouTube. I think he's talking to Joe Rogan, but where Jay and his wife were, I believe, in Vegas, and they'd been like he'd been hired to play what was obviously a mob function. It was like a wedding or something. And after they'd arranged a limo for him, and he gets into the limo after the event, and he's in the back with his wife, and they're about ready to go to dinner or something, and his driver was clearly, visibly, like a mob goon. And just one of those guys that go look at him, you can tell. And his wife kind of whispered to him, like, is this a guy, you know, he's like a madman or something. She's like, oh, you know, don't worry about it, honey. You know, I'll get a gun later. So he's kind of like joking with her. And the guy turns like, Mr. Leno, here, take mine. And he hands Jay a piece. And Jay's wife's eyes just go as big as saucers. Jay's like, oh, no, it's okay. So, no, it's okay. He's like, don't worry. The serial numbers are all gone. You just throw it away in your troop. And Jay's like, no, I couldn't. He's like, no, you can take it. He's like, okay. And so Jay has this like, almost really illegal gun with the serial numbers filed off. And as soon as it got out of the car, he just throws it in the first garbage can.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. He's got other even more interesting stories. But yeah, so where this relates to anime is this is the 80s and 90s, all sorts of original crazy stuff was getting made, and now it's all corporate, it's all, you know, we've got to be familiar. So anime is kind of like how Hollywood is now, where, well, if this series doesn't remind people of something from Eva or Dragon Ball Z, we can't do it.
I don't know. I've noticed some originality. Like, of course, like One Punch Man, you know, reminds me of all of these fight animes like Fist of the North Star and Dragon Ball Z and stuff like that. But it really is a masterful piss take on the whole genre of fighting animes, while also doing fighting animes better than anything that's come out in the past 10 years, including the recent Dragon Ball series that they've done. But anyway, the reason that I ask about the whole anime thing is because I noticed some serial numbers in the Therial.
Okay.
The big one is Jiren's Rodcaster.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask, is that a kind of veiled shout out or accidental reference? On.
Because I know what you're gonna ask, and I'm gonna blow your mind. So go ahead and ask it.
Okay. Is that a veiled reference or an accidental reference to Outlaw Star?
Nope.
No, really?
I wrote that before I ever saw that show.
Really?
Really. It's just...
That is cool as hell.
It's a case of two guys inventing the telephone at the same time, man. I mean...
Yeah, that's amazing. Because, like Outlaw Star is the only thing I've ever seen that did magic weapons. Like, where the bullets are actually powered by magic. And then Nathariel comes along, and I'm sitting here like, wait a minute. You know, there has to be a connection here, but no, apparently not. That's incredible.
Nope. And I can prove it, because if you look at the internal logic of the weapon, it's totally different than Outlaw Star. In Outlaw Star, Gene's caster, like, fires magic bullets, which are actually bullet rounds that are just enchanted, and they have different effects, right?
Right.
In Ethereal, and I even say this, the reason that the Gen came up with the Rodcaster is because they were fighting what are, for all intents and purposes, mages. So they figured, well, we will use our enemy's weapons against them and destroy them in the process. So it was a way of, it was a 1-2 punch, two birds with one stone. Like, we're destroying the enemy's rods while kicking their ass with them.
Okay.
So what Rodcaster ammo, like, literally is you take a rod and you cut it, like, into thumb-sized pieces, and you load it in there.
Okay. So the gun doesn't do it automatically. It's not like in the first Mass Effect where they have just, like, a block of metal slide into the back of the gun and it shaves it off automatic. You actually have to make the ammo for it.
Yeah. Here's the difference. Rodcasters themselves are not worked. They're not magical.
Okay.
The ammo is. With a Zephyr, the gun is magical and the ammo is not.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
That's why you can also front load it, just like muzzle load with a full-sized rod and blow it all at once, which has some unpredictable effects. I'm not going to spoil.
Yeah, we'll keep that part. I'll just say that was a really, really good scene.
Thanks. But yeah, Rodcaster's in dual purpose. Anyway, go ahead.
I just had to know, because that seemed way too close to be a coincidence right there. But that kind of did blew my mind. I don't really know where to go from here.
No, because I remember seeing the show for the first time on Toonami. It was the first time I saw it.
Toonami actually played good stuff.
Yeah, and it was right after it. I actually sat down and filled a notebook with I'd just gotten done designing the tech for Ethereal, actually. And I remember watching and going, oh, fuck.
Now we're going to get accused of ripping this guy off.
Yeah, and here we are. We've come full circle. The prophecy has been fulfilled. So, yeah. Well, and then there's also what would really...
Well, I didn't accuse you of ripping him off. Just
right.
To be clear, I thought it was just like a veil. Because I do that all the time in my writing that I've never published anywhere. I'll just like slip references in, some subtle, some not so subtle. But yeah, I just had to know, because like I say, sure. I do that all the time. So I was just wondering if that was, but
sure. There are places where I definitely did, but that wasn't one of them. But really, and that wasn't even the similarity between Outlaw Star and Ethereal that I thought people would call me on, that I was most afraid of. It was actually the Melfina Elena analog.
Melfina Elena.
Yeah, the similarities between Melfina and Elena. I thought people would.
Oh yeah! Now that you bring it up, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I didn't even make that connection.
Good. Because again, she's not.
I think that's the thing that made me gave me pause just before I asked you any of this stuff, was it's so different. Like it could be a reference to, or like this was my thought process while I was reading, like, okay, this could be a reference, but it's done so differently that if it is a reference, it's a damn good one. And you took that idea and did something else with it that was just, it might as well have been completely original. And it turns out it was. So, you know, there's similarities to Outlaw Star, but, similarities don't necessarily equal a causative relationship, I guess.
Well, well put. And yeah, Outlaw Star is one of my favorite anime series. I love it, but the creator of that series and I seem to have been drawing on some of the same influences, I suppose. Because I did watch a lot of anime, read a lot of American comics, watched a lot of horror movies. So I've said this in interviews with guys like Russell Newquist and John Mollison, that I think one of the reasons that, because I really don't think my work fits into either the pulp revolution or superversive SF or blue SF perfectly. It's its own thing. Yeah, but everyone from those different movements can find something to like in it. And I think the reason is that I avoided the trap that sci-fi writers just set out and said, okay, I want to be a sci-fi writer, because if you start on that path, well, nowadays, what does that mean? That means writing in the tradition of Clark or Van Vogt or Heinlein or Asimov. Yeah, or even Paul Anderson, Jerry Purnell, Orson Scott Card, some of the newer guys. And other than Frank Herbert, I've never read him. I've not read what's considered to be like the big three. Well, okay, I listened to a radio play of Nightfall by Asimov and hated it. So I can't do characters. But yeah, I think I tried to read 2001 and just couldn't.
Oh no, I do not blame you. Like I said, I watched the movie and immediately I had to watch it for a class in college. It was actually a pretty interesting class. It was like about sci-fi and the apocalypse. Like religious apocalypticness. So it was a very interesting class, but I really didn't see how, like, 2000... Like, we also read Childhood's End,
which
I enjoyed, but looking back on it from the perspective that I have now, it's like, wow, okay. But, yeah, 2001 was just a boring movie. It had some cool special effects, but that was about it. And then my brother actually went and read the novel back in high school when he was in high school. And I talked to him about it after watching the movie, and he was like, yeah, no, the novel's pretty much the exact same thing as the movie. It's just shit floating through space to classical music for, you know, however many fucking pages it went on for. Could have been a lot shorter.
Yeah, it vindicates what Jeffro and Night of War Pig and again, John Olson, Nathan Osley have been saying over on their blogs in the Castelli House blog. Okay, which is that after World War II, sci-fi editors in New York decided they wanted to become literary and, you know, butter up, you know, just kind of sidle up to the literati, right? And
we appear to be having some technical difficulties with your side of things. Getting a
little... Really, because I did... It might have been me. I was pausing to think.
No, I don't think that was. I think it's just Skype screwing up again.
Wonderful.
I'm
coming through better now.
Not exactly, but we will soldier on. Please, everybody, forgive us for these difficulties, because I finally got Brian here, and I don't want to give up this chance to talk to him unless Skype drops the call actively. So.
I think it's my internet connection.
It might be. I had this problem with Daddy Warpig. I'll tell you what we can do. let's go ahead and cut the call, and I'll stop the recording, and then we can start it up from your end, because I'm running the call and the recording right now. And we'll see if that works better, and then we'll start the recording back up.
And let me try and think while you're doing that, too.
Okay. Let me just stop here. Please pardon our dust. We will be back with you in a moment, folks. Okay, folks, we are back. We got it worked out. Got the connectivity issues solved, hopefully. So, what was we talking about when we cut off?
I don't know, but let's just start talking about something else, and I'm sure we'll eventually circle back around to it.
I think we were talking about the Pulp Revolution and the Superversives, and how your work doesn't necessarily fit into any of the kind of established literary movements that are going on, you know, assailing the crumbling walls of TradPub at the moment.
Oh, yeah, they are crumbling. But yeah, so my influences aren't what anybody being published by the Big Five really are. Because I came at it secondhand, filtered through the lens of anime or through the lens of American comics or through 80s and 90s slasher films. So the ideas are still there, but they've really been stripped of their literary pretensions. You know, Nightmare on Elm Street isn't really trying to say anything too terribly profound.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing that you can say for the slasher movies back in the 80s is that they weren't exactly the most pretentious things on the block in the day.
No, they're simple. Although Wes Craven did have a degree in philosophy, and it came through. It wasn't message fic by any stretch of the imagination.
But there were certain questions brought up in his work that, like, you can tell that the guy behind that has a little bit of a learned background, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Or you watch my favorite Wes Craven movie, The Serpent and the Rainbow.
That's one that I have not seen.
Oh, you need to see that. There's a lot going on there.
It's like, sounds interesting.
Well, like A Nightmare on Elm Street, it's the other Wes Craven movie that was partly inspired by true events.
Oh, okay.
Because you know how he read the LA Times article about, I think there were the Cambodian refugees, kids who were dying in their sleep of like massive heart attacks. They basically died from fear. And that's partly where he got the idea for Freddy Krueger.
I did not know that, but that is fascinating.
Really? Really? So do you know anything about the origins of Freddy Krueger? That's
not really, no. Like, honestly, I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. Like, usually when I get into something, I do all of the research on it and, you know, go look up all these obscure little interviews with the with the creator and stuff like that.
I'm putting you on the spot because this is a digression, but...
Oh, no, go for it.
Yeah, I'm glad to inform you this. Yeah, so Wes Craven came up with the idea for Freddy Krueger from three sources, three events in his life. One was the LA Times story I was talking about. The other was, I believe it was an Australian Maori legend about a spirit from the dream time who would stalk people and kill them in their sleep, in their dreams. Hmm. And then finally, he got the look for him from a terrifying incident that happened to him as a kid. He was home alone as a kid one rainy day and saw like this like fleeting motion go past his front window, and he went and looked out the side window.
Like a flailing motion, or
just a flailing, like someone moving past his window.
Okay.
So he went to the next window over to take a look, and this bum, like this vagrant, just basically jumped up and scared him on the other side. Just popped up in the window, and it was the most hideous thing Wes had ever seen. And he was dressed like Freddy Krueger, you know, had the ratty fedora and
the sweater and everything.
I don't know if he had a sweater, but if you watch New Nightmare, Freddy...
Oh, yeah, I've seen New Nightmare. New Nightmare's a good one.
Yeah, where the coat is kind of... It's not black, just kind of blue, I believe.
Yeah.
Blue or green. Yeah. He was dressed like that. And his face was... I don't know if he was burned, but his face was disfigured. And it's scary. I mean, he just locked all the doors and windows, just basically hid until his folks came home later. But it really made an impression on him.
Yeah, I can see that making an impression on a little kid.
Well, kind of similar to David Lynch's impetus for Blue Velvet. You ever heard about that?
No.
Have you ever seen Blue Velvet?
I have not. I'm not the biggest David Lynch fan. I'm more of like, you know, Carpenter, Craven, Cronenberg kind of guy. But
oh, me too. But I will tell you, I totally understand your aversion to Lynch.
It's not necessarily an aversion. I just haven't delved into his work all that much.
Blue Velvet is a great place to start. I highly recommend it, if only because you will get so many other references from other movies and TV shows, because it's really quotable. but I'll leave that there. But yeah, so that's where we came up with the idea for Freddy Krueger. Now, the sweater was specifically designed because red and green are the two hardest colors for the human brain to process when they're together.
I know how that is. I get all kinds of like weird, uncomfortable feelings when I see someone wearing those colors.
So my Christmas sweaters is a thing. So yeah. So Freddy's wardrobe is made to make Freddy uncomfortable to look at.
Okay. So there's a little bit of human psychology going on in the character design there. That's neat.
Well, yeah, because I believe Wes Craven had a dual major in philosophy and psychology, so he knows what he's doing.
That explains a lot, to be quite honest. Yeah. Like, a whole lot.
Yeah, doesn't it? So, but yeah, Serpent in the Rainbow is, it's about voodoo. It's actually an adaptation of a book by, basically the author is a botanist, and he basically wrote a Gary Stu character who's the main character of the book that's based on him, and Bill Pullman plays him in the movie. And in real life, he investigated the blowfish powder that is supposedly used to create real zombies. Like, put someone into, like, a state of hibernation.
Yeah, like voodoo zombie trance kind of thing.
Yep, and, like, his actually now apparently is a medical application to, like, anesthetics and stuff. Hmm. And it's about him, like, going to the rainforest and going to Haiti to research this stuff and, like, find out how zombies are made and gets more than he bargained for.
Okay. I'll definitely have to check this out.
Yeah, gets more than he bargained for in a Wes Craven kind of way. So, yeah.
So what's the name of this movie again?
The Serpent and the Rainbow.
The Serpent and the Rainbow. Okay.
Also the name of the book. Yeah.
The Serpent and the Rainbow. I'm definitely going to have to go look this up.
Yeah, let me know what you think.
But yeah, to get back to like all the, so we were talking about references and how your stuff doesn't necessarily fit into any one movement and all of that. I think that you're absolutely right about that, because while there is an element of the superversive, in my opinion, in my extremely unlearned opinion, because I'm not nearly as into it as the superversive guys are, I just think it's fascinating and a wonderful kind of direction to approach science fiction and fantasy work from. Even with that, there in Netherial, it's taken as read that there are gods that exist in this universe. Like the younger character, I cannot remember his name, and I'm kicking
Dame.
Dame. Yeah. It's actually pronounced Dame?
Yes.
Okay. Dame. Yeah. Like him, with his tattoos, and they'll kind of catch him in like moments of prayer and everything like that. There's this very, you know, kind of, I don't want to necessarily say sinister, but it's kind of sinister undercurrent of deities exist in this world. Like, God is real here. Maybe not necessarily, you know, the Christian God or, you know, any particular God from any particular pantheon that exists on Earth right now, but gods exist here. And I think that kind of brings that element, excuse me, of the superversive into the fiction. Because one of the things that I remember reading on one of the innumerable blog posts that I read when I first found out about the superversive movement is that they don't really care if you're coming at this from a Christian perspective. Just some kind of higher truth to the universe has to be present. And that's most certainly present in, sorry, I'm losing my voice. In Netherial. It's most certainly present in Netherial. It's just an internal consistency within the universe.
Yeah. Did you have a question about that? Is there anything you'd like to know?
I mean, if there's anything you'd like to talk about with that, I'd be more than interested to hear about it. Because like how you came up with the religious systems or a clearer picture, but you know, as spoiler free as we can make it. But I don't personally care about spoilers. I'm just saying that for the audience. Like if there was no one that was going to listen to this, then I would just sit you down and pick your brain for 3 hours over your book.
Well, the audience is who we're doing this for, so I understand. Yeah. open-ended religious question. Yeah, go ahead and get a drink of water, because I'm more than happy
I got a little bit right here.
Good. More than happy to expand on this at length. Yeah, so we're talking about Wes Craven. Whereas his background is in philosophy and psychology, my background is in history and theology. You know, that's my forte.
That definitely comes across in the writing.
Good. I'm glad I didn't take out all those student loans for nothing. So I approach this from a systematic theology point of view. And in terms of it being menacing, that's good. It really pleases me to hear you say that, because here in the West, you know, whether or not someone's a believer or not, you know, our conception of God is shaped by Christianity.
Oh, most definitely.
So
I wouldn't contest that at all.
Okay, so we've got this idea that of God being intrinsically benevolent and compassionate, and even having become one of us, you know, God even understanding us, and
to the point of ideas, living as a human for like 33 some odd years.
Yes, and yeah, that's really the Christian paradigm shift. Like I believe. It was either Chesterton or Lewis who said that paganism was the biggest thing that had ever been in the world, and Christianity was bigger. But these ideas I just talked about were completely alien to the pagan mindset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where their idea, because they had an idea of salvation
hang on.
As
let's,
well.
Let's just define paganism right quick. What perspective on paganism are you working from here? Because there's a lot of different versions of paganism, and that can include like Greek theology and Norse theology and Chinese and Japanese theology, and all kinds of stuff can go into paganism. So are we talking about some kind of amalgamation of that, like modern day Wicca seems to be, or is there a specific paganism that you're working from?
I'm working from classical paganism, so mainly Greco-Roman, but also, this will definitely have a bearing on Norse and Germanic systems,
right?
As well, and even to some extent, you know, things like Japanese animism. So, and yeah, even like later on, especially in the Solar Dance, we do get into more of the Hindu and Buddhist ideas, and it's called the soul cycle for a reason. But no, like the
Sorry, that would just tickle my funny bone a little bit.
Yeah. But the Greeks and Romans specifically, well, they had a concept of salvation, but none that a Christian would recognize. Because Christians think of a personal salvation from sin through the passion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that the grace is released thereby. In the ancient world, especially in the Greco-Roman world, fate was the idea. It was this all-encompassing, inescapable reality that fate binds everyone. You know, every creature.
Right, like with Oedipus and mm-hmm. you know that whole myth that with like nothing that they did over the course of that story, there was no way they could have taken an action that would have changed the way that story worked out.
Right, it's all predetermined. It's all decreed beforehand.
Right.
And you cannot fight it. Even the gods are bound by fate. Fate is even above the gods. But their idea of salvation was, like, you don't appeal to the gods to cleanse you of any moral iniquity, but to kind of intercede on your behalf with fate. Because, you know, a man's fate is different than a god's fate, okay? So even though a god You know, a pothole cannot change his own fate. You know, it is decreed, right? You know, Loki is going to
start Ragnarok, essentially.
Right, he's going to, I believe, be killed by his own son.
I think Thanos does eat him.
Yeah, I believe so. And there's nothing he can do about that. But because of the difference in order of being, a god has more clout with fate when it comes to mortals. So a god can't really bargain with fate on his own behalf, but he can intercede with fate for a mortal, just like you or I. You know, if there's an ant crawling along, and be like, okay, does this ant live or die? I can change this ant's fate by stepping on it or not, right?
Okay.
So it's scaling. So, you know, just like human beings kind of have dominion over, you know, lesser creatures, gods can intercede with fate on our behalf and kind of put in a word for us. So that was their ideas, like, you know, save me from my destiny, save me from my fate, because I can't. And that's why I make sacrifices, like to help crops grow and to avert disasters. You know, in ancient Rome, they had the College of Augurs, where if there was a plague or famine or a drought, these guys' entire job, and they worked for the state, they were civil servants, okay, because they had an established religion. Their job was to, you know, read the auspices, like bird entrails or cast lots or what have you, to try to find out, okay, why is this happening? Have we offended some god? Or then, you know, when we know why it's happening, who do we ask, you know, which god is best placed, best positioned to relieve it? So they would figure out why it's happening, who to petition to fix it, and then they would formulate like a liturgy or a sacrifice to appease that god so it would get taken care of. And sometimes it could just be something as simple as, like, you know, just sacrifice a bull, well, good. Or perhaps, you know, well, you know, the public officials need to declare like 7 days, like a 7-day public feast. You know, everybody's off work and we can drink wine and, you know, celebrate God's name. Or it could be bury a bunch of these political prisoners alive. And that's what I'm getting at, which is to basically everybody else outside of Christianity, the gods are not necessarily warm and fuzzy and friendly. They are terrifying, and their motives are not even really comprehensible.
There's so many, like, I keep bringing up this podcast, and I'm not getting paid to shill this guy. I just really like his podcast.
Go ahead.
The Myths and Legends podcast, he delves into like Greek and Norse mythology a lot, and he tells the stories in a really entertaining way, and he does his research. Like, I follow the guy on Twitter, and he's got pictures and pictures of just books and books and stacks of mythology books and stuff like that. But
nice.
You know, a lot of the stuff that he brings up in that podcast, and I'm not just going off his podcast, like, I have done independent research into ancient mythology, but you know, like Zeus, just Zeus, like fucking 75% of Greek mythology is everybody in creation going, Zeus, don't put your dick in that, and him going, too late.
Yeah, you're not the boss of me. Yeah, it is. So in a soul cycle, the gods that talk about, you know, whether it's Zadok or Thera or Elothan or Midras. Midras is really the closest thing to a benevolent deity that there is. But the others, they're not your friend. They don't really even care about you. They have their own agendas.
So they don't like listen to prayers or anything like that. Like Dame's whole thing is pretty much worthless.
Oh no, it's not worthless. Like, but if God answers your prayer, it's not going to be for your sake. It's because your purposes align.
Ah, so they have an expressed interest in what you're trying to accomplish.
Right. So it's not, there really aren't gods that are going to put themselves out for you, especially like not to the extent that Christ did, you know, suffering an ignominious, painful death. But it's like, okay.
Which he did not want to do. You know, like, I feel it's important to bring that up. Just like, you know, like I say, godless, atheist, heathen. But, you know, looking at that story and knowing as much about it as I do, like, there was a serious point where Jesus was like, you know, dude, I really don't want to do this. Like, he sat down and talked to God and was like, is there any other way we can do? Do I really have to die? this way. Okay.
So this is what we call signal grace, because I just came from Mass a few hours ago. Today's a Palm Sunday liturgy, because after sunset, you know, we go by the old Jewish rules that the day ends, the new day begins at sunset, not midnight.
Right.
So we celebrated the Sunday liturgy for tomorrow, and we read the Passion, including the agony in the garden. Mm. Whereas we're
well, twice you're probably a lot more familiar with it right now than I am.
Yeah, but you're correct. Where Jesus says, you know, Father, it would be possible that this cup pass through me without me drinking it, but not my will, but yours be done. So yes, because he's fully human. He has the drive for self-preservation that is natural to a human being. He was not masochist. He doesn't want to die, especially in the most excruciating. I mean, it's why the word excruciating means like supremely painful, right? It means from the cross.
Yeah.
Yeah. So of course
that's like the exact etymology of that word.
Yes, of course it wasn't his idea of a fun weekend.
But even though he was going to be okay, like he had intellectual knowledge that he was going to be okay throughout all of this. Like he's going to be fine. His essence, his consciousness, he's going to be okay. But that's still going to really suck to be nailed to a cross for 3 days.
Well, that was nothing. That's not what he was most averse to. That was the most painful part of it. The most painful part of it for him. The real agony of Jesus' passion came from taking all of human sins for all time onto himself.
Yes, you know, that's a very good point. I'm sorry I missed that. I'm lax in my theology, apparently.
No, that's fine. Because, I mean, of course, you're going to think, because like we're talking about, we're both human. Like, for you, yeah, the prospect of being nailed to a tree for several days until you slowly suffocate. Yeah, that's not fun. You don't want that. And only God can really understand the pain of it. Because, I mean, they found that the pain of rejection, even among humans, is some of the worst psychological trauma you can suffer. Like, in some cases, it can be worse than physical trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, imagine your God.
That's why women don't want to approach men.
Yeah. Imagine your God. You created a whole race so you could love them and they would love you back, you know, out of love. And they reject you over and over and over, all of them. And he felt all of that in one crystallized moment.
I understand why he sweated blood.
That is why he sweated. Yes. That's why he sweated blood.
That's a lot to hold on to, because not only is that, like, you know, everything up to that moment, that's also everything mm-hmm. that came after up to the end of the world. So, yeah, Jesus was kind of taking on a lot there.
Yeah, I mean, all the atrocities of every war ever, and like World War II, the Great War, French Revolution. And then every time,
even the two great wars, just like you're mm-hmm. like unimaginable suffering right there. Just
yeah. And then every time your eye stole a cookie as a kid, you know, that's that he felt that too. He felt, no, God, I'm not going to choose you. I'm going to choose something else. I'm going to make something else my, you know, my moral logic, my end. And that's a grave evil. So yeah, he had all evil just poured into him because, and I'm just going to go off on a theology rant here.
No,
because,
no, go ahead. Dude, I went to college and studied religion and sociology. This is my bag right here. Like we're dead up in my wheelhouse.
So. Right, I feel you, dog. All right. So the mechanics of why the crucifixion worked, you know, why did it purge us of sin, you know, pay the debt for all sin forever? Well, think back to the ancient Israel religion purification laws, right? You know, you're a priest, you touch a corpse, you can't be in the temple, you can't celebrate liturgy, you can't exercise your faculties, you know, until you undergo several days of purification. You know, a woman having her period, you've got to be shut away from the community. Anyone you touch is spiritually unclean. So the idea was
there's a lot of rules in Leviticus.
Yeah, Leviticus is just all about this idea of uncleanness, impurity, and then it can be transferred by touch. So if something unclean comes into contact with something clean, the thing that is clean is befouled. Okay? You know, that That's even one of the reasons.
I wonder if Muslims have the same thing when they slaughter dogs.
Hmm.
I wonder if the guy who held the knife has to like go into seclusion for a couple of days and pray.
I don't know. We have to find out, but I mean, we know they have purity laws. You know, halal, but good question. I don't know. I have to research that. But the idea is that when uncleanness is brought into contact with cleanness, the cleanness is made impure and has to be purified. Okay. So that is why, for example, like one objection to Jesus being the Messiah is, well, again, you know, in the Old Testament it says
Say that one more time. I missed it.
No problem. So one of the arguments against Jesus being the Messiah has been that, well, he's a convicted criminal who's hanged on a tree, and specifically there's a curse attached to anyone who's executed like that. Right? Anyone who's executed like that is unclean. Well, here's the thing, though.
That was kind of the point, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. Not if the one who's been executed is God, because God is the source of all purity. So he's the one exception to the rule. What happens when uncleanness comes in contact with God? You've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. The movie's theologically correct. The impurity is annihilated. His uncleanness cannot stand in God's presence.
I'm sorry, the Raiders of the Lost Ark thing. I just got visions of Nazis' faces melting in my head. And
yeah, well, that's what happens on Golgotha. That's what happens at the crucifixion, man. Is, you know, they open up the ark, except not mediated. You know, God is personally there. You know, if the ark is like a radio for talking to God, well, that's him showing up for a beer, you know, in a chat.
Hey guys, how's it going? Don't look at me.
Yeah, seriously. Like, even Moses is like, I'll tell you what, turn your back. Yeah, that's why.
Actually, Ben Shapiro kind of explained that in one of his podcasts, and I'm probably paraphrasing horribly, but like one of the reasons that I really like listening to Ben Shapiro's podcast, despite the disagreements that I do have with him,
mm-hmm.
Not just theological, is that every week the Jewish people go through a portion of the Torah. And he does that on air, live. So cool. He goes through a portion of the Torah, and he kind of explains what it means from his perspective. And it's very, very interesting listening. And he brought up that that bit about Moses and God saying, okay, I'm going to just, like, put my hand over your face, mm-hmm. and then you can see my back. Because, like, God is this, I guess you could say, super-dimensional thing. Like I say, I'm heavily paraphrasing, but...
He's Matt Cross, yeah.
Yeah, he's this super-dimensional being. The human mind cannot comprehend the face of God because he's mm-hmm. above existence. You know, we can't even fit all of existence into our head. We can't fit something that's beyond existence into our head. So he says, okay, I'm gonna just, like, block your vision for a minute, and then you can see my back, and then you can see the path that I'm leaving. And that he kind of said that was a metaphor for... like the law and the Torah and, you know, most of the parts of the Bible is that, mm-hmm. you know, God can't tell us everything, because mm-hmm. if we knew everything, it would blow our minds. We just wouldn't be able to function. But if we trust in God and, you know, follow the path that he has laid out, kind of follow at his back, see his back, see his path, and follow that path, then we'll be okay if God is a just, righteous, and loving God.
Yeah. And The gospel agrees with the Torah there. You know, there's much else that Jesus did that all of the books in the world wouldn't contain it, right?
What do you think about the Apocrypha? Because apparently Jesus wrote a book in that, and I haven't gotten around to reading it yet, but, like, I don't know if the Apocrypha is, because I know you're Catholic, so, like, is the Apocrypha considered heresy, or, like, do you guys read that to, like, you know what path not to take, or is it just, like, completely discounted?
Okay, so explaining the Apocrypha, because that's a loaded word. It has different meanings for different people. So, for example, what Protestants call the Apocrypha, we call the Deuterocanon, the second canon, because it is canonical.
Okay.
Like we have, the Catholic Bible has 72 books. I hope I'm getting that right.
That's pretty incredible, because, like, the regular Bible has, well, I want to say 64, but I'm probably misremembering the number.
I believe it's a difference of of 12. It's been a while. Because I got into Systematic Theologian. It's been a while since I had my old and New Testament classes, like 10 years. Even though I do read it regularly, but I don't read the whole thing. Let's see here.
It's okay. I don't think anybody's expecting us to be 100% accurate right now, especially
I don't
want to
give
a
scandal.
Drinking, yeah.
But that's okay. I've got my external. Okay, 70. Yeah, 73. Although there is a different accounting. Sometimes one book is split into two, but yeah, so the seven books that are different.
Okay. So you guys have like about seven extra books in your version of the Bible.
Right, yeah.
And I'm really, really trying not to be like insulting, so if I say something that ticks you off, let me know. And I'll work to correct it because, honestly, I've never actually talked to a Catholic about theology before. So if I say something that's screwed up or I misinterpret something or, you know, basically if I fuck up, then let me know, with regard to, you know, how your theology is interpreted, because I'm not all that familiar sure. with Catholicism, so. Just like forgive my ignorance, essentially, is what I'm saying.
Well, of course, absolvo te. I went to school to exactly to help clear up intellectual obstacles and to relieve ignorance, specifically of Catholic theology. So that is why I'm here. So yeah, basically, the books we've got are Tobit, Judith. Some additions to Esther from the Vulgate, Book of Wisdom, the Book of Sirach, Baruch, including Letter of Jeremiah, and then some additions to the Book of Daniel, and then, of course, the first and second Book of Maccabees, Maccabees 1 and 2. Mm. Now, like the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and I believe even like the Greek Orthodox Churches, they have what we consider to be apocryphal books that they consider canon. So like the Book of Jubilees and like 3 and 4 Maccabees. I don't know if they consider the Didache, but...
Right, there's also the Book of Enoch and stuff like that.
Right. And stuff that's obviously heretical and Gnostic, like, Gospel of Thomas. There's even, like, Gospel of Judas and stuff. Yeah. But
I still haven't read Thomas's Gospel. I think that would make for very interesting reading, though, because that was the guy who was, like, you know... I'm not going to believe it until he shows up. You know, Jesus has to show up, and then he does. And Thomas is like, like he just had a fucking meltdown right there.
Well, the Apostle I had to burst your bubble, but the Apostle Thomas almost certainly did not write the Gospel of Thomas. It's a Gnostic text written like hundreds of years after the fact.
Yeah, that's the real problem with all of this, because I took a course on the Gospels, actually, like the four accepted Gospels, mm-hmm. Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of debate in the theological community about where these Gospels came from and when they were written and who wrote them, and it's a total clusterfuck trying to work all of that stuff out. So I have no doubt that the Gospel of Thomas is, you know, not actually written by the guy Thomas who's in the Gospels and was the doubter.
Right. But in terms of the
But it
the
it's
Catholic
it's
canon,
fun it's fun to imagine that it was.
Right. Where the Catholic and Protestant canons diverge is because of the Septuagint. Now, for the audience's sake, because you probably know what that is.
I have an idea, but I don't remember the exact definition.
Well, remember the Babylonian exile, where basically the ancient kingdoms of Israel and Judah were dismantled by the Assyrians and the Babylonians and taken into exile. They had to adapt, practice their religion, you know, away from their homeland.
Right.
And Greek came to be really the universal language in the ancient world. And so fewer and fewer people spoke Hebrew, and the Jews in the diaspora realized, okay, well, we need a new translation of the Bible into Greek so that everybody can read it. Right? It's kind of like what Jerome did with the Vulgate, translating it into Latin, which, you know, in the Middle Ages and, you know, Dark Ages was the, you know, lingua franca of of the West. So, right.
And then, like, further on, you know, translating it into local languages so that the mm-hmm. ordinary person could read it.
Right. And so where the name Septuagint comes from is they got 70 translators. And Septuagint comes from the Greek word for 70 to translate the Old Testament. And that is the canon that the Catholic Church accepts.
Okay, so the Septuagint is the mm-hmm. kind of like the basic Catholic Bible.
Right, we accept the Septuagint. Jesus himself quotes from it in the Gospels on a few occasions. And it's what was accepted, you know, for thousands of years and you know, over a thousand years until the Reformation. And guys like Luther, and I know that this is a really short answer, but you know, I don't have forever. But basically, they argued that, well, the Jews of the day, after it was called the Council of Jamnia, did not accept the Greek texts. They only ruled canonical the books originally written in Hebrew.
Right. Like the stuff that you go into a Jewish synagogue right now, and you'll see like they have the books right there in the Ark. And
you know, yeah, exactly.
Which I've actually done. And if you have the opportunity, just mm-hmm. anybody out there to go to a Jewish synagogue and actually see the Ark that they have there that houses like the Torah and the different books that they have, it is such an intense and moving experience. Like, good Lord. I wouldn't classify myself as humbled by religion in many points after I kind of became an atheist, but that was one of the points where they actually like opened up the Ark and I saw all of these scrolls there that are written on lambskin, handwritten on lambskin. And I kind of broke there for a minute. Like I couldn't deal with the amount of history and I guess the word that I'm looking for is reverence that mm-hmm. I was seeing. And there was no one there. Like we didn't even have the priest, the rabbi with us at that point in time. It was just my teacher in this class that I was taking in college. She took us to her synagogue and it was intense, boy, just.
You never know where you're going to find channels of grace. So good. And that's an awesome story. So to bring it back to the soul cycle where this originally started, now that people have an idea of what my spiritual background is. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. The prevailing cosmology and theology in Netherial are definitely not Christian. Now there are of course hints of it because I'm Christian and you know the
Kremlin
is revealed in the work. Yes, exactly. It's going to bleed through. There's at least one direct biblical reference near the end. Many people who reviewed the book have spotted it. So it's pretty obvious. But is it something that is going to be revealed fully in the fourth book?
Oh, so but, that's a setup for something later. Okay. I see where you're going.
Yeah. So I'm not going to say what's behind all this, but just on its face, the soul cycle cosmos is very old. Okay, it's like at Netherial, it is on its last legs. So
yeah, that's kind of the impression that you gave with the book. Like everything's like the universe itself is kind of winding down.
It is, yeah, and even the point where you know there used to be this whole pantheon of gods and like a rich diversity of different faiths and cults, but even the gods have largely lost interest in this universe because it's just dying, and there's really nothing to their advantage there anymore. So most of them just left. You know, they just sought greener pastures. But as we find, not every aspect of the old gods may be gone. They might have left some vestiges behind, and perhaps more than that. And that's all I'm going to say. But yeah, they more cast a shadow, I suppose, over the story of Netherial. So yeah, there's Dane really kind of flailing and grasping at straws, not really, you know, having this inner drive, kind of a vocation towards something, but he doesn't really know what it is, and he's reaching forward as best he can. But of course, you know, he's not being led by know, gentle and loving God who cares about him. So that story doesn't necessarily end happily.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that you really brought forward in that character very well, in my opinion. Like Dame's character, I actually identify with Dame a lot. I had this crisis of faith. I don't really like getting into why it happened, but basically my mom died of cancer and I grew up Southern Baptist. Like, I was in church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. I was there. You know, I wholeheartedly believed in this, and I had people around me telling me that, you know, oh, she's going to make it through. She's going to make it through and everything like that. And, you know, when she finally passed, I had this immense crisis of faith. And for the longest time, I still believed in God, but I hated him. And then, you know, I kind of developed beyond that, depending on how you want to look at it. Maybe I regressed, or, you know, different people will interpret it different ways. I'm over it now. I'm not looking for any condolences. I'm just kind of laying out what happened. But I started you know, uncharitably be described as shopping around for different faiths. Cause I figured a man has to believe in something, you know, you're just going to walk around with no God watching out for you. What kind of existence is that, was how I was thinking at the time. So I was kind of reading a lot and groping around for different faiths. And I didn't really have a full understanding of how they worked. So I did a lot of research. So I really kind of identified with Dame's struggle there. You know, he doesn't really know what he's getting into. He just has this feeling that this is the right way to go, and he's going forward full steam and damn the torpedoes. And that's not a level of, I guess, faith that I could bring to my own spiritual quest at the time, but I do see where he's coming from, and that really struck a chord with me. So that character was very meaningful to somebody like me. I really like Dame's character.
Well, good to hear. And see, he should have been like you. He should have followed your example and done more research. You know, fools rush in, or angels fear to tread.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. Yeah. Should have done his homework. Oh, well, hindsight's 20/20. So, no, was there any other questions you had for me? I know that's really open-ended. I'm sure there are, but I do got to get going in probably about 10 minutes here.
Okay.
Do you have time for one more?
Well, honestly, it would probably get into another another like 20-minute answer. So if you want to go ahead and cut it here, we can cut it here. It won't be a problem. We've been going on for about an hour and 15 minutes or so, adding up the time, you know, from the two recordings. So, well, Brian, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I really appreciate you coming on. It's been great talking to you about this and kind of picking your brain about the soul cycle. So thank you for coming on, man.
My pleasure, sir. And anytime. Yeah, I had a blast. Thanks to everybody for listening. Can I get a plug in for my stuff here?
Definitely. Go ahead. Tell everybody, you know, anything that you got to sell, where they can find you, all of that stuff.
Sure. Well, you can find me at BrianNiemeyer.com. That's my blog, Kairos.
All this will be linked in the description, by the way. So if you're looking for easy links, then go ahead and check out the show notes. But sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, thank you. Important tip. Thanks. And right now, as many of you may be aware, John Scalzi has just released his latest sci-fi opus, which Tor Books is selling for $12.99 an ebook.
Ooh.
On Amazon. Ouch, yeah.
Ooh.
So what I did is this month, in honor of Scalzi's latest triumph, is I've made all three of my books $12.97. So you can get all three of my Soul Cycle books, Ethereal, Soul Dancer, and The Secret Kings, for less than one copy of Scalzi's book.
Which, by the way, I'm not saying this because Brian's on the show right now. I'm saying this because I read the damn book. Go buy it. Take advantage of this deal that he's got going on right now. This is some of the best fiction that you will ever read that was published after 1980, okay? Go buy Brian's books.
And they only get better, folks. He's only read the first one. You go and read the comments and the Amazon reviews. People are saying that SoulCycle just keeps getting better. So I don't know if I'd agree, but that's what people are saying.
I can believe it. I can believe it.
And the Puppy of the Month book club, Puppy of the Month book club with our buddies, Nathan Housley, John Mollison, and the Frisky Pagan is covering Soul Dancer this month. They do incredible in-depth reviews, about on the caliber of your audio review of Netherial from a while back, Jim. So that's going on right now. Also currently working on a book for Castelli House. All I can say is it's going to be a space opera.
Very much looking forward to that, by the way. That's like two of my favorite things getting mashed together. It's just, I have full faith that it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, thanks. I've only got really like two chapters left on the first draft. I'm going to immediately do the second. So hopefully, we were originally looking to get that out next month. We'll see if we can make it. I know Vox has another book in the same series to release first. So it's going to be kind of the prelude to mine. Another guy's working on it.
Okay.
Yeah, and then mine.
So you're like kind of doing this collective universe thing where a bunch of writers get together and write in the same general timeline.
Yeah, at least two of us right now. Me and my editor. So he's a great guy.
I thought it was Jaji again.
No, Jaji is the editor for the SoulCycle. Castelli House assigned me my own editor with them.
Hmm.
Who's also writing the first, like, introductory book to the series. Like, his is going to be the intro, and then mine is actually going to be book one of this trilogy set, like, in this universe.
Okay.
So I'm sure Vox wouldn't mind me saying that. I'm not saying anything specific. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
We love Vox Day here, so I'm sure that he wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah, I love him as more than a friend. So I can definitely say that. So yeah, he's great.
Just saying, Vox, if you're ever in America, look us up for a beer and a steak.
Yeah, he's not coming back. He's not. But anyway, yeah. So that's what I've got going on. Oh, also, John Mollison himself does a little audiobook narration on the side, and he just finished up Forbidden Thoughts, the sci-fi anthology that I'm in with Fox, Leah Kria, Jaji, Sarah Hoyt, Brad Torgerson, Nick Cole, John Stewart, and Milo Yiannopoulos does the intro. So that should be coming out soon from Castelli House, the audio book version of Forbidden Thoughts.
Yeah, I have heard about that. I'm very excited for the audio version. I saw Raul Nianzi's review of the book itself, and he was not exactly kind, but he wasn't exactly like coming in with torches to burn the town down or anything like that. But it kind of made me a little bit trepidatious. But for the audiobook, you know, published by Castelli House, read by John Mollison, featuring some of my favorite writers, I think I can shell out the dough for that.
let me reassure you, okay, because I know it's poor form for a writer to gainsay his critics. So I'm not going to, because the thing is, if you notice, if you look at the actual reviews or in the comments of Forbidden Thoughts, the main complaint seems to be that this gets a little too close to being message fix sometimes, just from the other direction.
Right.
But then when I ask about, like, okay, well, what in my story did you think was message fix? Because I worked really hard. Like, my primary goal is, okay, I'm not going to make this message fix. I'm just going to tell a good story. Rawl and the other guys who have made that claim have said, oh, well, except for yours. I'm not talking about your story. Like, Alfred Jennison and Justice Gamer and Rawl have been like, well, no. Okay. Elegy for the Locust, which is my story, which is set in the Soul Cycle. It's a prequel to Netherial.
Oh, so going a little... Oh, okay. So it's a prequel to that. Well, I'm buying the book then, you know?
Well, there we go. Yeah, they said, no, my story is not message fic. Mine is exempted from that charge. So just to let you know,
even if it is message fic, I don't necessarily have too much of a problem with that, just as a way to kind of combat the zeitgeist that's been going on for the past, you know, 20, 40 years. But, you know, it was kind of disappointing to read his review and get the impression that this was just like the same thing that we've been hearing for 40 years, but from the other side, like the same method applied a different way. But if a Netherial prequel is included in that, then that instantly sweetens the pot to where I'm willing to put my, however much the ebook at least costs. So
yeah, it's reasonable. It's like $5, but yeah, Jason Rennie contacted me and said, "Hey, you want to contribute to this?" And I said, "I don't really know what I do." And John C. Wright said, "Well, think of a short story as one chapter of a novel. Approach it as you would just writing a chapter of one of your books." And I said, "Well, people have been asking me for more SoulCycle background. So, okay, I'll give him a Lovecraftian Poe style horror story that fills in, you know, colors in some more of the edges of the SoulCycle." So yeah, it's got, hints of the origins of one major faction that shows up in Secret Kings. It delves into a bit more of like the history of the founding of the guild and like the purge of the Gen and stuff. Tells a little bit more about how the magic system works, and the people who've liked it. I mean, one reviewer called it fantastic. People have compared it to Poe in like tone and theme. So apparently did something right.
I honestly, I think you're doing a lot right, and I think you should continue doing a lot right.
Right back at you.
But honestly, I don't think that you're going to be able to help it, because given the quality of your work so far, you releasing something that's subpar seems just like out of conception to me. I'm not trying to ride your dick here. I just really like your writing that much. I don't think it's possible for you to release something that's subpar, because you see all of these pitfalls going on, and you've blogged about them and you've talked about them at length. So I think you know where to avoid stepping, and you do a damn good job of not stepping in those places.
Thanks. I put a lot of effort to it. It's always in the back of my mind when I'm writing anything. And I'm going to tell you, Jim, if you had been the only person to say that you were entertained by something I wrote, then all the hundreds of man hours I put into it would have been worth it, man, you know, just for you. So
that's another thing that I just got to say before we cut out here. I really do respect you for the approach that you take to your writing. Like you view your readers as your bosses, and what they want, they get. So, you know, you're out here trying to entertain people, and you take criticism into account, and, you know, all of that stuff, you know, as little criticism as there is, but
well, I've got critics.
it's really encouraging to see somebody come out here and say explicitly, "I'm not this big, you know, swinging dick writer who's doing a 12-book epic and you will like what I put down." You come out here and you say, "I want to entertain people. If people aren't entertained, then I'm doing something wrong. And I need to listen to these people who aren't entertained and then, you know, adjust my method accordingly." It's really encouraging to see that come out, because there's too many people out there nowadays who are just, you know, "I'm going to release a 12-book epic like Game of Thrones or some shit, and, you know, damn the torpedoes and all of that stuff. Damn the readers. Who cares what the fuck they think?" You know, well, you'll care what they think when the sales numbers start coming in.
Yeah, if you're indie, if you're self-published, or if a small publisher like Castellia House, I have yet to come across a Castellia House author or an indie author who has that entitled, arrogant attitude. Mainly where you find that is with guys published by the Big Five,
mm-hmm.
who are very insecure themselves, and they derive their entire sense of self-worth from being a big sci-fi author. Right? If you've ever seen the nerd hierarchy, where it's like, "Oh, well, cosplayers think they're better than gamers, who think they're better than furries, who think they're better than more gamers, etc." And at the top is, "Sci-fi authors think they're better than everyone else in fandom." And no, guys, no, We are not their masters. We are their servants. We are dancing clowns, dancing in the hope that they will throw pennies at us and one will stick to our foreheads and leave a mark, right? That we can collect at the end of the day and say, thank you, sir. May I please have another.
Like one thing that I would kind of add on to that is that if you have a specific vision, like I'm one of those people who, when I write, I just write and the words manifest themselves on the screen and I have, you know, I can go in and make it sound pretty, but what happened happened. So I wouldn't encourage you to, you know, police yourself or alter your vision of how a story is supposed to go simply because people react to it badly. There's right. been a lot of people reacted to a lot of stuff badly, that actually, turned out to be a good thing. You know, so far as like the context of the story goes, like I just think back to anime that I've watched recently, and then a certain thing will happen and people will freak the fuck out about it for a week straight. And then the next episode comes out and they're, you know, oh, everything's brought back in context now. And we understand why this cliffhanger, this little thing was left the way it was. So, you know, just kind of be careful with that because this is supposed to be about, like, I'm not reading your books because you are listening to your audience and taking criticism into account. I'm reading your books because you are doing one of the most fiercely original things in fiction that I have seen in, how old am I? 29 years. That's why I'm reading your books. It's original. It's your vision. It should go the way you think it needs to go. And if people don't like the way that the story needs to go, especially with something like the Soul Cycle, then they're wrong. But you know, it is important to take criticism into account and, you know, refine your writing technique and things like that. But just be wary about taking any criticism out. And I don't need to tell you this. You've published,
no,
you know, three whole books more than me. So.
I can always use a reminder, man. I mean, that feedback is helpful because a lot of people just come and enjoy the ride and don't think about, you know, tipping the valet, and that's fine. No, I want you to enjoy yourself and not feel obligated, but I do appreciate all the feedback I can get.
No, I definitely want to tip the valet. I want to tip the valet because the ride was fun, even if I don't like everything that happened along the way.
Yeah, I'll tip the driver. But you telling me why you read my stuff, that is valuable. That I can use. That's applicable.
Well, I'm glad to help you out, man. Anytime.
right back at you. Thanks.
All right, so we about at the end here, or did you have something else that you want to say? Closing thoughts, finishing up, telling people where they can find you?
No, I'm on Twitter, just Brian Niemeyer, big B, big N, everything else lowercase. I'm on Facebook, I don't use it as much, but I try to get in there. I'm on Gab, try to, you know, make the rounds of Gab at least once a day. But, you know, I'm around. If you want to get a hold of me, you know, I've got an Amazon author page. But no, otherwise, it's a nice night. I think I'm going to get out and take a walk and kick some ideas around.
All right, that sounds like a plan. But yeah, like I say, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, man. It was a hell of a lot of fun tonight. And hopefully we'll be able to do this again sometime. And amen, eventually brother. I'm going to have to get Dornell on here and complete the the Geek Gab set.
He'll tell you all about D&D, all about his game. It's fascinating.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that he had a game in the works. That should be an interesting conversation. Now I'm going to have to actually get off my lazy ass and get in contact with him.
Yeah, Gamey's running, so yeah.
All right. But yeah, like I say, thanks again for coming on the show, man. A lot of fun. I have to do it again sometime. And I just hope that everybody else out there wasn't annoyed by all the theological discussion that went down. But yeah, so go follow Brian on all of his social media accounts. Once again, they will be linked in the show notes. Go buy the Soul Cycle series. This is not an if, this is not a maybe, this is not you know, well, it sounds cool, so I think I'll check it out. No, go fucking buy it right now. Go.
If you do not do this, Jim has a problem.
you go click on the Amazon affiliate link on my blog and you buy Brian's books. Okay? All right. But yeah, okay, so I guess that's the end of the podcast. Thank you everybody for listening. There'll probably be a sponsor roll after the end of this, but whatever, we'll deal with that when we get to it. So Brian, thanks again for coming on. We'll definitely have to do this again. It was so much fun talking to you, man.
Likewise.
All right. Well, I'll just go ahead and end the recording here then. Peace out, everybody. All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. I really do appreciate your kind attention and tuning in and spreading the word and telling people. Very awesome of you. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast with Brian. It was a lot of fun to record and put together. Sorry about the technical difficulties that we had, but unfortunately that was unavoidable, but we did get it fixed, so. Anyway, thanks again to Brian for coming on, and you should all go buy Brian's books. There will be a link in the description to the Amazon page where you can find them, and as I said, they're very good, so you should all go buy them immediately. And there will also be links to his website and his Twitter and his Gab. So if there are other places where Brian's at on the internet, then I don't know where they are. But all of that stuff will be down in the show notes. So go check all of that out. And now we get to the sponsors. Just do this at the end of every episode. So if you would like to support what I'm doing here and, you know, help me turn this into a full-time job, which I'm working on it, but... you can help me out by buying the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks. I recorded numbers 6, 7, and 8 in this series. It's very good, superversive military sci-fi. I had a lot of fun recording these books. They were very enjoyable to read. And I can promise that you're getting quality when you buy my narration of them, and I do get royalties off of those. So that's one way that you can help me out. Next, Dimension Bucket Media actually has books for sale. Now, they're only in paperback right now. We're working very hard to get them into ebook and audiobook, since those are more accessible to most people and generally cheaper. But those will be coming. But right now, it's all in paperback, and you'll be getting them from CreateSpace, essentially. But we have Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is the first book by a British author, Hell Richards. Her first published work, contracted out through us. We're very happy to be bringing that to you guys. And we also have Dimension of Cobwebs, which is a collection of old weird tales by classic authors, including Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe, but also some less well-known guys, so that's a very good deal for your money. We also have Darkest of Dreams, which is an original short story anthology. So this is a basically a self-published collection of short stories. It's 3 short stories each, and I can promise that you're gonna absolutely love them. They're all quality, so well worth the money over there. And like I say, we're trying to get these out in audio and ebook, so those will be coming very soon, and I will let you guys know when it happens. Next, we have Aaron Cleary, Old Man Cleary, Captain Capitalism himself, the asshole in asshole consulting. Aaron is an economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, and he also runs a consulting business called Asshole Consulting at assholeconsulting.com, where he will tell you how to fix your fucking life problems. So if you fucked up your life, go pay Aaron $35 and he'll tell you how to dig yourself out of the hole. He also has several books, 2 of which I have done the audiobooks for. Now, he paid a flat rate, so I don't get royalties, but they're very good books, and you should go pick them up anyway. There's a lot of good advice in there. Aaron is a good man, and he knows a lot. So, just go check Aaron's stuff out. He also has a YouTube channel if you're more into that. Next up, we have John E. Boyle, the writer of Queen's Air, which you can find... Oh, man, shit, I need to put that... that advertisement up on the blog. I'll put an advertisement up on the blog today. But you can find his books on Amazon under John E. Boyle. That's B-O-Y-L-E. And he wrote Queen's Air and has contracted me to do the audiobook. And he's been very understanding about some medical problems and other shit that I was going through. So I owe the guy. He also made it possible for me to get medical treatment for my eyes and get my car fixed by sending me an advance on the audiobook. So I owe the guy big time. And the audiobook will be coming out soon. I mean soon. Like, we're talking within a month and a half soon. But yes, you should go and buy the book. Next, we have the affiliate programs, which are Amazon. So if you're going to go do any shopping on Amazon, if you're going to pick up any of this stuff from Dimension Bucket or Aaron Clary or, you know, any of that stuff on Amazon, go over to my affiliate program link. It's not a fake link. It's an actual Amazon link from Amazon, the company. And you just click on it, and it takes you to Amazon. You buy whatever the fuck you want, and I get a percentage as commission for driving traffic to their website. Doesn't cost you anything else. So far as I know, it doesn't infringe on the profits for the person selling the stuff. I think Amazon actually takes that cut out of their third of the money. So, if you're going to buy any of this stuff, go through my Amazon affiliate account. I don't think you'll get a discount, but it would help me out. So that's kind of what this role of people here that I've spent 6.5 minutes going through is for. It's, if you want to support me, this is how you do it. So next we have mycomicshop.com. I also have an affiliate account with them. Now you can't click on the little gift that they have, the thousands and thousands of comics thing. You have to click on the words above it that say buy new and used comics at mycomicshop.com. I couldn't figure out how to get the link into the GIF. It would not let me do that. So I had to just paste the link in there and then, you know, just paste the HTML code in and then put the GIF underneath it. And that's the way that worked out. But if you need comics, this is a very good service. I buy comics from these people all the fucking time. I've never once had a problem with them. And the packages always arrive in like 8 layers. So, like, not even water damage can get, like, you could drop this package. It's a cardboard box. You could drop this box in the fucking ocean and your comics would be fine. They do not fuck around when they're packaging up your material. They want it to get to you and get to you safely. They also have tons and tons of new and used comics. So if you're looking for something specific, you could go on there and find that. If you want old Marvel comics, they have that. If you're, you know, not a fucking scrub and you've already gotten off the Marvel DC woo hype train, they also have stuff by other comic publishers like IDW, you know, and Image and stuff like that. So go over there if you need comics. Good service. Highly recommended. I use it all the fucking time. That's why I got the affiliate account. I saw that they had one, and I was like, well, I might as well fucking sign up for that shit. You know, because I give these people money all the fucking time. I might as well get a little kickback. Next, we have RightStuffAnime.com. So, RightStuff is, like, your one-stop shop for fucking everything anime, manga. Like, they have figurines, they have music, they have all kinds of merchandise. It's also a very good service. Just like mycomicshop.com, I've never had a problem with these guys. They always send me my stuff in a very quick manner. They process the orders very quickly. And they always put a lot of packaging in with your items that you're buying to make sure that they don't shake around or get damaged, bounce off the inside of the box and shit like that. I mean, that's where I get all my anime stuff. Like, all of the manga that I buy from Right Stuff. You know, that's why I got the affiliate account, because I've used this service for a couple of years now, and I fucking believe in it, and they've never let me down. So, like I say, I've been giving them money for a long time now. I might as well start getting some kickback from it. But it's a very good service, and you guys should go check it out. Once again, use the affiliate link if you're going to actually buy something. Then we have the Bandcamp. This is definitely least. I got some narrations up on my Bandcamp. You can find those in the store. They're the ones with the really unprofessional-looking covers that just look like somebody slapped some text on a black background, because that's exactly what I fucking did. I have no idea how to do graphic design. But those are some narrations that I have. I have my Halloween special from 2014 that I did for my YouTube channel. I have a bunch of narrations of the Holders' stories, which you know, like the holder of honor or whatever, or the holder of color, stuff like that. You know, you guys know the fucking website. Well, I did a bunch of narrations. I did like 15 narrations for a cancer charity that wound up never going anywhere. We didn't even take any money. It just kind of like died on the vine before we could even get things set up and actually start taking donations. So I published a couple of them, and then I just put the rest up on the Bandcamp. So if you want those, it's like never-before-heard narrations. You can go get those if you really, really want them. And that's about it for the sponsors. So yeah, and like I say, don't forget, Dimension Bucket actually has stuff for sale on Amazon right now. You can get Dimension of Cobwebs, you can get Darkest of Dreams, you can get Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, you can get Cracked, and I think we have a couple of other ones that I can't remember the names of right now. It's a lot. We put out like 6 or 7 books all at once, so go buy them. Use the affiliate account link. Anyway, I'll shut this down now. I've been going on for almost 12 fucking minutes about this shit. So thank you guys again for listening. Thanks, Brian, again, for coming on. It was wonderful talking to you. I had a great time, and we'll have to do it again sometime. Thank you guys all for listening. I'll catch y'all next week. Peace out.